Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the must not take yourself too seriously and 6-1 since that matters. And what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble. With exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Namaste, motherfuckers. Welcome to Namaste, Motherfuckers, the only podcast where the worlds of comedy, self-help, and business collide. I'm your host, Callie Beaton, and today's episode is called Fight, Flight, and Feminism. My guest today was hailed as one of the new suffragettes in Vogue magazine. It was actually the Daily Mail where the word suffragette was first used back in 1906. And in the 1908 board game, Suffragetto, you could play as either the suffragettes or as the police. The aim of the suffragettes was to break into the House of Commons. The aim of the police was to break into the Albert Hall, where else, and disrupt a suffragette meeting. Sounds a bit shit, but I bet it didn't drag on as long as Monopoly. Over 100 years later, in 2017, the United States Senate voted to require Senator Elizabeth Warren to stop speaking during the confirmation of Senator Jeff Sessions as US Attorney General. This gave birth to the feminist mantra, "Nevertheless, she persisted." There are some brilliant t-shirts with that written on the front. I even thought about buying one. I thought it might make me look fat. It's irony, motherfuckers. Calm down.
I've shut myself away in a little bedroom at the top of the house. Is the sound okay and not too echoey?
The sound's really good, actually. Yeah, it sounds good. And thank you for putting headphones in. That makes a very big difference.
That's my guest today, author, political activist, journalist, and founding leader of the Women's Equality Party, Sophie Walker. My favourite activism fact is that there's an American anti-circumcision activist called Richard Angel, who used to go by the nickname Dick Angel.
As long as you discount the 250 boxes in the stables.
In the stables? Listen to you, it's like Downton Abbey.
It's a very dilapidated Downton Abbey.
As the leader of the party, Sophie oversaw a manifesto with six core objectives: equal representation in politics and business, equal representation in education, equal pay, equal treatment of women in the media, equal parenting rights, and an end to violence against women. Just 10 months into her second five-year term, Sophie stepped down from the party. She went on to say, "I think that sometimes in order to lead, you have to get out of the way." Sophie's book, Grace Under Pressure, Going the Distance as an Asperger's Mum, chronicled the day-to-day life of raising her daughter Grace alongside training for a marathon. Her subsequent book, Five Rules for Rebellion, Let's Change the World Ourselves, presents an inspiring five-step journey to incorporating activism into our lives. Sophie and I talked about imposter syndrome, running, single parenting, feminism, optimism, ageism, professionalism, cynicism, presenteeism, autism, and some things that don't end in ism. I started by asking her about suddenly finding herself a public figure as the newly elected leader of the Women's Equality Party.
Yeah, I struggled with that. I struggled with being public. I struggled with understanding to what extent I was public. I struggled with understanding to what extent I was allowed to be really me and public. It felt like there was a lot of there's a lot of pressure on public figures to be, in inverted commas, authentic, which is a word I really detest.
Why do you detest that? Why do you detest the word authentic?
Oh, because it's become an ad man's word. There's nothing authentic about the word authentic. it's a shorthand. It's a shorthand for meaningful glances.
Yeah.
From the heart, sound bites.
So the kind of fake real self is what it's come to mean, the opposite of what it actually originally should mean, which is actually really having your, because you did need to, I think anyone involved in the Women's Equality Party, when it was founded, you know, 6 years ago, nearly 6 years ago or now, you kind of do need to have the courage to have your own voice, right? I mean, yours wasn't necessarily a welcome voice in the political landscape of the time.
No, I think, well, yes and no, actually, I think there was a lot of joy and optimism when we launched. We were really catching a wave of sort of joyful frustration, really, if that doesn't sound too Mary Poppins. there was a lot, I think it was a time when people had really, women in particular, really felt that we needed to sort of do something, capital D, capital S, about the lack of women's representation, the lack of policy making for women. I mean, you know, there've been thousands and thousands of fantastic women doing grassroots work for decades on this. And it is, as we know, often the job, particularly of women from minoritized communities. So Black women, disabled women, lesbian and gay women, to step into the spaces that are left by failed policymaking and, you know, devise solutions and support for and by themselves, right? So, you know, there's always been that work. There's always been that work. And it's always been absolutely essential to supporting women's particular needs. I think what we did is, what happened at the beginning of the Women's Equality Party was that we captured a more sort of top line understanding that, like, that we needed to have a voice, and that it was a political voice. It was I think what was so exciting about it was that it was an unapologetic, politically feminist voice that said, you know, feminism is a political ideology in and of itself, and it deserves its own space in the political atmosphere, rather than something that gets co-opted by other parties when they try to remember to sort of do something for female voters. And yes, I did, you know, I think I didn't know what I didn't know. And it was an ongoing process of coming to grips with that. And also, I think the push-pull of, you know, as a politician, you're expected to be, you lead. There's a certain amount of frankness and honesty that you have to bring to that job if you're going to be, I think, any good at it.
And you were very much an amateur politician, as you described yourself, because everybody, for anyone who doesn't know, the Women's Equality was founded before the May 2015 general election by Sandy Toksvig and Catherine Mayer. And Sandy sort of famously said, "I've made jokes over and over again about politics this election. I've had enough." And you didn't really mean to, you didn't go in thinking, "I'll lead this party," did you? You got involved and then quickly became leader. Is that right?
Yeah, I got involved. I mean, I went along to put the chairs out at the meetings. I went along as somebody who had been dynamized into activism by my daughter's diagnosis of autism. I'd been a reporter for about 20 years for an international news agency. And I had, during that time, you know, worked in often a very male atmosphere, often feeling quite uncomfortable as a woman in that atmosphere, often feeling not good enough, you know, that imposter syndrome that lots of women talk about, or pushing it away, having a child, trying to juggle work and children in a way that I didn't really see my male colleagues struggle with to the same extent. And then discovering that my daughter, my daughter was having a really bad time. It took us 5 years to get a diagnosis. At that point, I was a single parent. I was, you know, trying to pay the rent, keep my job, and, you know, leave work early pretty much every day to go and pick up my daughter, who'd been excluded again for what was essentially bullying against her. So when, you know, that election came around in 2015, I was really pissed off. You know, I was like, where is an understanding of the specific experiences of women? Where is the understanding that we don't care about care, because women do it. Where is the understanding of the multiple intersecting experiences of women from all sorts of different communities who experience discrimination in more than one form? It just felt that politics had got so, so limited. So when Catherine said she was setting this party up, I was like, right, I'm in, what do you need? And I went along to the first couple of meetings, and I think I spoke at one of them. Catherine invited me to come and talk about care. And I really just felt like, oh, yes, this is a space where we can really do some serious work.
Do you think we get driven to, I guess, when people think about being an activist, a political activist, people think maybe that's something that it is something we, it's sort of like, not a vocation, but something that's kind of in our blood. But actually, lots of us become activists because we reach breaking point, right, with the way things are. And you and I have in common that we have, autistic kids with Asperger's. And fighting that fight without getting heard, and the sort of discrimination there seems to be against people who need help, whether they're the carers of the kids who need the help or the kids themselves. So my son also, it was about a 3-year process to get him diagnosed. And was it that kind of despair that drove you to activism rather than you always thinking of yourself as an activist?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, when I was writing my book about this, it was really interesting interviewing other campaigners who nearly always said, I don't consider myself an activist, because it's, you know, I think there's quite a male idea around activism of people who sort of abseil onto oil tankers for Greenpeace, you know, or sort of sit in a treehouse to stop an extension for 3 years, or, you know, there's a sort of slightly...
climb up Everest in tweed plus fours and then go on the public speaking services about it.
I don't know, but you know, there's a slightly sort of macho element to some understandings of activism, and the women I spoke to, almost to a woman, said, I'm just doing this because it needs to be done, you know, and I was driven to it from often from despair or anger, or actually that moment where you realize nobody's coming to the rescue and you're really going to have to do this yourself. And that was very much what propelled me into WEP. I had absolutely no intention of ever being a politician at all. And when, I was asked to lead the party, I spent quite a while thinking about it and talking to my husband about it and figuring out whether this was something that we could manage as a family. And I, you know, I really think, you know, we only managed it because my husband is, a total superstar and, a soulmate and a feminist. And, you know, he basically said, you know, I've got this, I've got the rest of it, you do it. So I was able to campaign for hours and hours and hours and hours and all day, every day, and weekends and evenings, and know that there was, you know, he was like cooking the tea every night and doing the kids' homework with them. And, you know, it was a wrench for me so often in those years to be away from my children for the extent that I was, and particularly, you know, having an autistic child who really needs certainty and structure and routines.
And this is Grace, right? This is your firstborn. So Grace, who is now, what, in her late teens?
She's 19, yes.
19.
And an art student.
Amazing. And I see your updates on social media, and I know you've described her as seeing being autistic as a superpower now. And I want to hear more about that, because I think for my son, it's been a bit of a mixed blessing, particularly during the pandemic. But you wrote Grace Under Pressure, right? You wrote, which was a blog that then turned into a book. And it was also about you running a marathon, right? So this was about the day-to-day life of raising Grace, raising a kid newly diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome and running a marathon. So lots of people might say, well, kind of, yeah, that makes your life, it sounds like a sort of double difficulty, but actually it was your salvation, right? Sort of deciding to reinvest in your fitness, your well-being, or what happened with that? Because that's a bit of a pincer movement of challenge, one might think.
Yeah, I can see why it might look a bit crazy from the outside. But it was very simple, really. The only thing that helped me, that I considered helped me and Grace at that point, was the National Autistic Society's helpline. I've
got that speed dial still. It's an important resource.
Yeah. And, you know, and I wanted to make sure that that helpline kept going. And I thought that, you know, I'll run a marathon, I'll raise money so that that helpline keeps going for people like me and Grace who really need it. And also, I was really unwell. I was diagnosed with clinical depression. My daughter was very low. And I felt like I needed to get physically strong for both of us. Otherwise, something was going to give. So it was a mixture of the sort of practical and physical and spiritual as well, if I'm honest. You know, I really needed to shore both of us up with the resource that was the kind of resources that were achieved by doing those things.
So you're training for a marathon, which I know, having run marathons as well, is, you know, at 4-hour training runs on occasion. You're raising a daughter with Asperger's syndrome. You've stopped being a single mum by then, right? So you yes. at some point met your amazing feminist husband, who was kind of part of the engine room of your political career, and had another daughter with him, and he's got two sons, is that right? So you've got four kids in the family.
Yeah.
And at that point, when you're thinking about sort of reclaiming yourself, one of the things that I think is interesting for people who are as driven as you are is, I guess, where does the kind of play come in? Where does the fun come in? Where do you ever give yourself a little bit of slack and say, you know what, I'm just going to do this for fuck it. I just feel like doing this. Did that bit get a bit buried, do you think, at that time?
Yeah. Next question.
So you, because everything you were doing was for a purpose, right? Even resigning, yeah. I looked at your resignation sort of statement when you left the Women's Equality Party, which was quite early into your second 5-year term, right? So you could have kept doing it for 5 years. And what you described it as, which I thought was really lovely, and you sort of jokingly said, oh, I hope the white men out there are listening. Or maybe you didn't say white men, I hope men out there are listening. But you said it was less stepping down, it was more sitting down, inviting others to join you at the table. And I just want to read one bit from your statement, which I found really moving at the time. And I found it moving when I read it again. You said, I offer my hand and my help to women who may never have considered that they could change the world, because we need new leaders, and the leaders who will change the world will be the women we haven't met yet. And I thought that was such an unusual way for a leader to lead, by getting out of the way. So what happened at that point when you made that decision and you wrote those amazing words?
Well, I had always been very aware of my privilege in becoming the leader of the Women's Equality Party, in that I was initially asked to do it because we didn't have the structure to have a formal election process. You know, at that point, we were still a bunch of women around a couple of kitchen tables. And I think I was asked to do it because I would be sort of the one at the end of the meetings who'd be like, right, but what are we actually going to do?
the journalist in you trying to bring
points,
it home.
Action points, yeah. So I went into the leadership knowing that I basically had been in the right place at the right time, essentially. And as I learned more about feminism you know, the work that so many of in the sisterhood had been doing for so long, I also began to understand that, you know, as a white middle-class woman, there were experiences that I could only speak about, you know, academically, really. You know, you can offer so much support and solidarity, but representation really matters. It really, really matters. And I think you know, we don't have enough white middle class women in politics. We certainly don't have enough black women or disabled women or women from the LGBTQ plus community in politics. We don't have enough women from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. You know, I just felt like, I really felt like it was time for me to make space for women with different voices. And I felt like, and also, I was running out of steam. I was very, very tired. You know, as you pointed out earlier, I had not had much time for play. I had been driven by a sense of purpose that was verging on something that was slightly damaging, actually.
Was it a kind of obsessive? Because if you look at your career, it's I talk about this a lot when I do my kind of public speaking, the gap between the self that you convey, which is real, into, I'm loath to use the word authentic, but the real you that is the you that's hugely high achieving, it might really be you, but the gap between that and another part of you, which is the part of you that's more childlike, more vulnerable, more needs to play, the gap can be really big, even though you're really being yourself. The voice you had in the Women's Equality Party really seemed to be your voice. But I guess if you're budging out room for the bit that doesn't have to be strong, that doesn't, then that's where you start to pay a price on the inside, right? The gap between how you're feeling and what you're doing, if it gets big enough, something has to give.
Yeah, that's beautifully put. That's really beautifully put. I think that, you know, the period during which we were doing WEP as well, the political landscape changed massively. Mm. I mean, just massively.
The strong man syndrome started to happen, didn't it, unfortunately?
Yeah, so that doesn't, you know, that makes it, you know, a feminist politics even more necessary rather than less. But in terms of leading the party through those 4 and a bit years, it was a real roller coaster. And we started off with that sense of joy and optimism. And, you know, the sort of 10 months after we'd opened for membership, I was running for Mayor of London, which was an absolute blast. And then
your first conference in 2016 in Manchester. I was at that, and it was just, it felt like you were Beyonce on the night. I did some of the comedy afterwards with Sandy and Sarah Pascoe, and it just felt like it was such a time of optimism. It came sort of not too many years after we'd had the London Olympics, and everything felt full of hope and unity, and anything was possible. And it's incredibly depressing, even for those of us not directly involved in politics. I guess we're all involved in politics, or we should be. But I mean, democracy's kind of on the wane, unbelievably, and we've gone so far to the right and so far away from those things. So even to those of us who weren't on the heart of the inside of it, the thought that at the time you were looking for sort of equal representation, equal pay, basic.
Really things. Basic. Well, that was the thing that was so tough. You know, so Brexit happened, the country splintered along whole new political fault lines on top of the ones already existing. There was, you know, Trump was elected. There was a sort of growing acceptance, really, of, you know, misogyny and sexism. In fact, it was more than acceptance. They were being put forward as a valid thing to vote for and, you know, and align yourself with. And I would be going to do, I'd be increasingly invited along to do debates, in inverted commas, about women's equality and all aspects of women's equality, where I would be put up against a misogynist in a nice suit, and, you know, and we'd have at it. And, you know, it was really a very tough thing to do. You step off out of the studio, and your phone lights up with abusive messages. It was very difficult to decide, that we would do that stuff. We had to get out in front of the audience. You know, we were a small party. There are barriers to small parties in this country. You don't get seen and heard so much, and you don't, you know, there's a sort of real acceptance essentially in the media that this is a two-party system. And so I felt like I had to get out there at every opportunity that was offered, even when those felt really very stressful, and often the personal impact stayed with me for days afterwards. And I think, you know, so that combined with a growing sense that we really needed to fast forward feminism a bit and get, you know, make more space for women from minoritized communities to be seen and heard in a way that's supportive, right? Not just sort of you go out there and let them have at you now. It was what I was trying to say was, when I stepped out of the way, was like, we've really got to
to nourish your leaders, right? You have to find a way once they're there, because it did strike me that it's very easy to take the leader of a party, and, you know, I'm not beyond having a pop at Boris Johnson, so I can't say I don't have a pop at the leader of parties as well, but it seemed very personal on quite an extreme level, what happened to you and the sort of trolling you got and the abuse that you were getting in every sort of aspect. It seemed to be hating on you as it hating on you for speaking out. I remember that time, I'm sure you read about it, the Elephant in the Valley study, which was a study of women in tech in Silicon Valley. And 84% of those women had been called aggressive during their careers as negative feedback, and no men had that adjective applied to them. And there's almost this implication that if you speak out as a woman who believes in things, you're there to be slapped down again, which it does seem to still be a relic of something quite patriarchal, because I don't think men are getting slapped down for speaking out. They might get slapped down for speaking out in a way we don't appreciate. But how much of that do you think is about gender, and how much of that felt very personal?
All of it. I think, you know, I've lost count of the number of times that I've been called a man hater, either from, you know, anonymous accounts with a Union Jack in their bio, or from those who are still on the path to learning and understanding what it means to be an ally to feminism. Namaste,
motherfuckers. If you had to define feminism in a sentence, how would you define it?
It's freedom. It's freedom. It's, you know, it's liberation. It's women's liberation. I wish we'd called ourselves the Women's Liberation Party. You know, I think that what is, you know, I know what we mean by women's equality, but I think that there is an essential lack of freedom for women that I really want to talk about more and point to more. You know, we make choices in a context, and the context for women is, oh, it's bruising them and hurting them and making them small and pushing them into poverty, wounding them. And
there's still a need to diminish to diminish women, I think. And when we look at what might actually enlarge the experience of being a woman, and I think there is this misconception that if we talk about feminism and we push for that freedom for women, that we're saying we want to bring men down in order for that to be the case. But what we're trying to do is bring women up. It's not about bringing men down. And in fact, you know, male allies are enormously important. What would you say then is, if you want to be a feminist ally, whatever your demographic is, what would you say is the most important thing anyone can do, anyone who's listening can do?
Well, I think it does matter what your demographic is in terms of what your allyship looks like. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a white, middle-class, non-disabled woman. What I'm trying to do is point out all the ways in which all women from different experiences, from different backgrounds, have different experiences, and how we need to respond to those in specific and different ways. I think, you know, what I've always said to men and will always say to men is, you know, we need your help and we need your voices, but we also need you to understand how to give space to our voices, and how to understand that you do benefit daily from structures that were set up by white men largely for other white men largely, and getting aggressive and defensive about that doesn't help. You know, the sort of hashtag not all men, we all of us to some extent as white middle class people live with privilege from existing within systems that benefit white people and non-disabled people and you know, people from the higher socioeconomic classes. And it's uncomfortable, right? It's uncomfortable. Like I've had my ass kicked so many times. I had to learn humility. I had to learn to go away and just take it all in and you know, and consider my bruises and think, okay, so maybe I asked for that.
Next book, Consider My Bruises. I mean, it's obviously, you can see why play anyway with anyone who achieves what you've achieved career-wise, why play and fun and that kind of guard down self gets a little bit pushed to the side. But particularly when you're dealing in this kind of area, which is such a it's not a funny topic, you know, the way in which women, violence against women and girls is not a funny topic, and to campaign for that to stop is not a funny business. But in your book, which I should give the full title, give it a good plug, so 5 Rules for Rebellion, Let's Change the World Ourselves, which came out in paperback earlier this month. And by the way, I should say that your side hustles are bigger than most people's hustles. You do sort of things quietly on the side, and I'm like, oh, if I managed that in a 10-year span, I'd be quite happy with that. But you're this was really to look at kind of activism full stop, and also activism for women, I guess. And it started with three kind of rules, didn't it? Despair, anger and hope. And then you expanded them out into compassion and perseverance. It kind of reminded me when I read it about those the cycle of grief, you know, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. I was so I wondered, and again, I'm not saying you've plagiarized the cycle of grief, but if you look at that and where you get your energy for that, so we're looking at, you know, those five elements you talk about in your book. So how can you do that and still live a life where you allow yourself to be the person you are, to be frivolous, to be spiritual, to kind of save yourself? How do the two coexist?
That's such a good question. I mean, when I left WEP, I was very clear that I wanted to set up some form of practical support for women to run for political office, particularly for women from minoritized communities to run for political office. And so with some friends I set up, we went about creating Activate, which gives money, you know, it takes money, takes finances, cover the childcare, the petrol, you know, all the things that women struggle with when they're... But I was also really conscious that there was a philosophical element to activism and to campaigning. I took I took several months of really not doing very much, which I think was, I'm not sure I'd ever done that really before. I sort of lay on the sofa with the curtains drawn and watched every episode of The Good Wife.
You talked about being depressed in your 30s when Grace was diagnosed. Do you think you were depressed again? Because that not wanting to get out of bed and wanting to shut the curtains and fade away is obviously in keeping with depression, right?
Yeah, I think I was. But I think it was a different kind. It was, I mean, this sounds terribly dramatic, but it felt like my soul was burned out, right? There was something at the core of me that was a very small, sad-looking little cinder, and I needed to sort of find the fire again. And I kept thinking, how do you do this? How does one do this and not end up like this? How does one do this and keep going? I was doing a lot of reading as well and a lot of nourishing, you know. You have to put in order to have something to create. And I think it had been a while since I'd been able just to really absorb other thoughts and ideas and rest and do that kind of, I mean, it's awful. Furlough's got such a terrible association now, doesn't it? But it you know, in the oldest sense of the world, it was like giving myself some fallow time to nourish the soil a bit. So anyway, that's where the book came out of. I suddenly realized that it wasn't a series of pitched battles. It was a philosophy for life, and that it was cyclical. And if I could work out how to continually, you know, defeat despair, channel the anger, understand that hope is a very powerful tool, be able to collaborate with compassion and get the right mixture between empathy and you know, not getting lost in sort of slightly therapeutic approaches, and, you know, and persevering. I just felt like if there's something I can usefully do here, maybe I can offer some support to other people who might be feeling outfaced by this.
I think it's a real Sophie Walker move in a time when you're thinking, I'm just going to let myself do nothing, to then do something that is quite something, and manage to produce, a book that's so important, because activism isn't therapy, is it? And people, I think, sometimes mistake the need to sort of, we need to express where we're at with things, but crucially, what do we actually do and what do we each individually do? But if you're so even that time of kind of collapse with the curtains shut and all that you went through when Grace was diagnosed, you're still driven. And people say, don't they, if you're so driven, what are you driving out? I'm sure you've heard that. I get asked that. What do you think the answer is?
I've been doing a lot of work on myself, actually, over the last couple of years. And I think I... I had very little self-authority. I think it's something, I mean, I know that sounds like a slightly bonkers thing to say from someone who sort of regularly goes out, crosses the street for a fight. that's what Anne Oliverius, who I am now working with, who's this brilliant feminist lawyer, says, you know, I'll always cross the street for a good fight, and oh my God, I love her for it. But I think I can see why that sounds a bit of a strange thing to say, but I think I absorbed everything that everybody said about me. I was trying to be all things to all people, and there was an element, I think, of sort of martyrdom about it. And I think that's what was, that was what in the end became damaging. I felt like I had to be the person, the feminist, the leader, the advisor, the mother, the sister, the daughter, the wife. I had to be it in all of it, because I hadn't understood that I was already enough. I know this is where we really do get into sort of namaste motherfuckers, but in spending some time on myself and doing some therapy and some, you know, trying to establish a meditation practice, it really helped me to understand that one is enough, right? Life is a long, if you're lucky, experience of learning and appreciation of what's around you. But it's a sense of yourself somehow that I didn't have before.
It's that sense of resilience, isn't it? It's funny how, and again, I don't want to project my own shit onto you, but I think you've got boundaries. But if we think about being, you know, whatever a strong woman is or a strong person in the world, it's funny how the more I used to, and, you know, when I was kind of in the heady sort of boardroom days of my career, and the more I used to really try and convey this bulletproof, resilient exterior, the less I actually felt like that on the inside. And it was actually when I did a course after I'd suffered from depression, I did this, there was a particular mindfulness course that is a kind of 8 or 9 week course, and it's rolled out all around the world. It's a kind of mindfulness for people who've suffered depression. It's got a catchier title than that. And you'd have to practice mindfulness for an hour a day. And I would sit and do my mindfulness and just cry to begin with, because everything came in that I'd been driving out all those busy years. And it was almost like a PTSD reaction I also had, also to my son's diagnosis, after all those years coping as a single mum. And you do just have to cope. People say, you're brilliant coping. It's like, what else am I going to do?
Yeah, exactly. How are you doing it? And like, well, don't have a choice, actually.
No choice. Yeah, there's a child that needs raising and there's money that needs earning. But it's interesting. And you talk about this in your despair. You say, looking closely into your despair, you'll discover your way out of it. I say your despair, I mean, in your book. I'm in the Five Rules book. But it's funny how sitting with the stuff that's so difficult actually sort of takes away some of its negative power, because you think, actually, I can just accommodate this. And I know we're getting into real kaftan wearing territory here, but I can sit with this stuff and it isn't going to derail me and it isn't going to destroy me. But has that, you've still got, we should say that you've got, I mean, a massive job again. You're chief strategy officer for a multinational law firm specializing in violence against women and young girls. So it's not a light job you've got now. You've gone for another top level big job with big, bold, important aims. So where is there, through all this stuff you're doing, you know, meditation, therapy, stopping, looking, absorbing, what have you found underneath all of that then? Who's Sophie Walker now?
Oh my goodness, like, could this, yeah. It's just been like, you know what, I still feel inherently uncomfortable about talking of myself at such length. I mean, that question makes me go, oh God, can we talk about,
well, because you think it's self-centered to want to talk about who you actually are as opposed to what you do in the world?
Yeah, exactly.
So it's still about, unless it's got a purpose, why are you saying it? Is there still that feeling?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, it has been really interesting to me that when I started doing meditation and I was listening to some sort of guided stuff, and I mean, I can laugh about it now, but at the time, I think the first time I had somebody, in a voice in my head, say, repeat after me, I am love. I was like, what, are you joking? Like, that this voice was so opposite to anything that the voice in my head, you know, I am I am love and I am good and I am connected to the universe. Like the voice in my head for so many years had been, I am a bit shit. I am not good enough. I need to try harder. And so I think where I've got to now is I am trying to be useful. And I am also spending a lot more time trying precisely not to worry so much about whether that, you know, the extent of that usefulness, or, you know, I'm just doing the stuff that's in front of me that seems to be helpful. I'm working for McAllister Other Berries because I think they are a superb firm. I think there is an essential activism in the way that they approach their cases. They are trying to build a better world by making the law work better for everyone. If I can be a part of that, then, you know, I consider that I'm doing a decent job.
And we'll put a link in the show notes to who they are and the sort of work they're doing for people who are interested to hear more about that and what they might also be able to do to help in putting an end to violence against women and young girls. I just want to ask about an age thing. You're just behind me in age. I think, am I allowed to say it's your 50th this year, I believe?
Yes,
is that right?
It is. Yeah. Indeed, yeah.
Maybe just out of lockdown as well, you might be able to actually have a bit of a 50th. Maybe not full on licking people at an orgy, but something fun.
Yeah, I had hoped that I might turn 50 in Ibiza, but I think I'm going to celebrate turning 50 by getting a bit further up the vaccination list instead.
Yeah, it's really worth getting into that age group. Just to get, I've just been vaccinated as someone a bit older than you who's also asthmatic. I'd really recommend having a respiratory problem at a great age if you really want to get helped. Do you think there's, I'm going to say something that is potentially controversial now, but being a woman in your 40s, so it sounds as if you had a pretty challenging decade. I certainly had a real life-changingly challenging decade. Mm. And a lot goes on with women in their 40s socially, hormonally, stuff that people talk a lot about, the menopause, which obviously happens more likely in your early 50s. But actually, I think all that shit kicks off big style in your 40s. I don't know many women in their 40s who haven't gone a little bit off beam in ways that were slightly beyond their control. What do you think about your experience as a woman in her 40s? Do you think that's been relevant to all the stuff you've had to do, the work on yourself and the changes you've made?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think there's I'm trying to give you a detailed...
What I'm saying is, did you go batshit crazy because you were in your 40s?
I'm trying to give you a detailed and interesting answer, but the short answer is yes.
Yeah, yes. That's fine.
I think I did it feels like I lived about 30 years in a decade. I feel like I did some of the toughest work I've ever done. I did some of the biggest, steepest learning I've ever done. I did some fairly essential work on myself that was long overdue. It's been a hell of a decade.
Yeah, I think when people say it's a roller coaster, that's something of a cliched understatement. If it's any consolation, Sophie, I can highly recommend The View once you get a 5 at the start of your age. I felt so brilliant. The day I turned 50 and the day after, my kids threw a sort of surprise party for me and nothing grand, but I felt so relieved. I can't explain it more than that. And I feel as if I've become less invisible since I turned 50. So I hope that you benefit from a similar decade to come. What would you pick as your namaste motherfucking life-changing moment?
That I think that moment actually when that voice in my head said I am love, and I was like, oh wow, that is so completely different to the voice I've been carrying around in my head for the last most of my life. I think it really shocked me, and I think that there are probably quite a lot of women who walk around thinking I'm a bit shit in either this way or that way or the other way, and I would say, you know, from me to them, this is me saying you are love too. This is our hippie moment. You are love, you are enough, you are yourself, and you are connected to the universe, and you're fucking brilliant. So don't listen to that voice.
It's funny that we both have seen the need to slightly self-deprecate, haven't we? And we can't quite just say it still. So we've learned that that is a thing. When I did the Hoffman process, which I've talked about on the podcast before, there's one bit which may sound weird to people who haven't done it, but where your sort of individual kind of teacher leader through the thing, and he, in my case it was a he, and they do this to everyone, it wasn't just me, or it would have been weird. And he looked at me and he said, "I see you and I love you." And I lost my shit. I cried for about an hour and a half. I don't think, and that it was the combination, the fact that someone might actually see me as I actually am, and they might still love me, was blew my mind. So that's a really, so that's a lovely thing. And it's just, maybe one day we'll be able to say these things without going, without apologizing, saying them and having seen the light. Yes. So to give us a chance to be irreverent and silly again, favorite joke. What's your favorite joke, Sophie?
I remember telling this joke to my mum and she laughed and laughed and laughed when I was little, and now that I'm her age, it makes me laugh and laugh and laugh, and I completely get it now. A woman goes to the doctor and says, "I think I'm losing my memory." And the doctor says, "When did this begin to happen?" And the woman says, "When did what begin to happen?" There you go, there's a menopause joke for you.
I almost don't think it's funny because it's too close to home. So I've got well beyond the "what did I come upstairs for" point. I literally, someone said to me the other day that they'd forgotten what their address was. They'd been filling in a form and they were set, and I was thinking, oh no, I literally am almost at the point sometimes where my full name, I'm like, wait, what's my middle name? And obviously days of the week are long gone, partly lockdown, partly menopause. Yeah, that's a good that's a good joke. What was the joke? No.
What joke? Sorry, what? Who are you? What are you doing here?
Yeah, why are we here? That is a good existential question. So talking of existential, last question. If there was one bit of life advice you could give to anyone listening, what would it be?
I would go to the first rule, I think, given where we are, given what we've been living for the last year. I would say don't be defeated by despair. The fact that you're despairing at all means that actually you do want more, and that is that's the light, and that's the hope. So follow that.
The only way out of the shit is through it. I think someone said that to me a long while ago, and it's a helpful thing. We'll put a link to the book, Sophie, in the show notes for anyone who'd like to read it. Thank you so much. It's been really lovely having you on the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it.
Namaste, motherfucker. That was the inspirational Sophie Walker. Every episode, I pick a thing inspired by my guest that I am going to try. I am a runner, but I'm not one of those blindly determined, breathing all over people during a pandemic kind of a runner. I'm more the kind who accidentally buys running trainers two sizes too big, goes running, falls over their own feet, cracks two ribs, and has a black eye that 4 weeks later still makes me look like Ziggy Stardust. And anyone who follows me on social media will know that is not a word of a lie. But I really like the idea of running not for distance or pace, but because I am enough. So this week, I'm going to try taking a more mindful approach to my running. I'm going to try not falling over. And I'm also going to read a book I can't believe I haven't read yet, which is What I Talk About When I Talk About Running by Japanese novelist Haruki Murakami. Oh, and a shout out to my daughter who has just completed the Couch to 5K. There's no danger of her ever listening to this podcast, but I am still very proud. So that's the show for this week. Thanks to Sophie for joining me. You can find links to her website and social media and all the other good stuff in the show notes. Namaste, Motherfuckers was written and presented by me, Callie Beaton, and was produced by Mike Hansen and Karu Shadami for Pod People Productions. Music by Jake Yap. If you've liked today's show, please subscribe now on your favourite podcast app, and also rate and review the show, not because I'm needy and crave external affirmation, but because it helps other people find the show. We'll be back in your feed next Monday when I'll be talking to much-loved comedian, actor, writer, and now children's author, Rosie Jones.
My life moment of... For 6 years, I thought, I can't be on camera because of how I speak.
I'm Callie Beaton. Until next time, motherfuckers.
Namaste, mother.